Hello, Ms. Austin Fitz. I'm sorry about the little delay, but we're gonna.
No. That was fascinating. Is there any chance you're gonna do a translation?
I think we can do that. Yeah, we have a good friend who is making abstracts of most of our sessions, and he gives it English subtitles. That helps.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
Okay, let me give you this is a brief introduction. You were an assistant secretary of housing and urban development in the Bush administration. You're also a former investment banker. You've done lots and lots of other things. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself?
So if you go to Soleri, my website is soleri.com, which is the Soleri Report. If you go under About Us and just click down under my name, you can get a full detail with, just about everything. I'm arguably one of the most over-investigated people you will ever meet in your life. So I'm a great believer in transparency. So my way of dealing with many, many government investigations was to simply just put everything up on the internet. But that's it. I'm basically an investment banker. I'm interested in money. I became Assistant Secretary of Housing and then started an investment bank in Washington. And the company was interested in using internet technology to help decentralize wealth creation. So decentralized currencies, decentralized equity markets, et cetera. And the company was extremely successful. And then we were targeted in a sort of enemy of the state. I don't know, who here has seen the movie Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman? I played Will Smith in real life. And in fact, his office in the movie was right next to my office.
Wow.
So I spent 11 years engaged in 12 tracks of litigation, 18 audits and investigations, and very serious smear campaigns and physical harassment with the Department of Justice and all their friends. And my way of coping with it was to try and understand what was really going on in the broader economy and why the Department of Justice was basically using criminal means to centralize control of the economy and engage in massive financial fraud. And so I started to publish in 1998 about what I called the financial coup d'etat. And a lot of what we're seeing now is simply the consolidation after 20 years of financial coup d'etat. And we'll talk about that more. And I made a decision that rather than go back into the establishment, which was what I was offered a chance to do, that I would continue to try and figure out how we could decentralize financial markets and the financial system in a way that would lead to freedom. And that I felt that what my former colleagues were doing was not only criminal, but I just thought it was not going to work. So I thought they were embarked on the implementation of a global governance and financial model that would fail. And my feeling was, even if it succeeded, I'd rather be dead in the wilderness than with them in the, in the underground basis. So that's what I've done since. And I started two businesses when I finished the litigation, which was very successful to our surprise and amazement, a sort of a miraculous thing. But I started two businesses. One is the Soleri Report, which is really our tagline is helping each other have a free and inspired life. So the goal is to, sort of help each other in practical ways figure out how we can build a human civilization with a decentralized money system. And then the second is the Soleri Investment Advisory Services, which used to do investment advisory for individuals and families, helping them manage their resources. And I closed that down in 2018 because the regulation just got to be impossible to deal with on an economic basis. And now I just do an ESG screen, which is I work with a money manager. I choose the stocks. And what we're trying to screen for essentially is to screen out any company that has a business model, which I would describe as organized crime. So we're looking for companies that are fundamentally productive, not perfect, but just fundamentally productive, that do something useful for their, for their customers and their employees. And that's for people who don't want to be essentially financing with their retirement savings the kind of corruption and criminality we're watching and you guys are dealing with. And I just have to say, I'm a great admirer of what you're doing, and I really appreciate it. So it's a real opportunity, and it's an honor to speak with you.
And vice versa. We haven't met each other, but through a mutual friend, James Henry, we were kind of connected because he first he filmed an interview with me here, right here, actually. And a little bit later, he filmed the one with you, which, of course, was taken down almost immediately by YouTube. But I think,
That was the strange thing, because the first thing I did was I watched yours, and then he put mine up. And, you know, normally whenever I do a video that goes, when it hits 100,000 views, they stop it or censor it or hiccup it. And this one they let run for, I think it was, it might have been because it was over Christmas, but they let it run almost up to 3 million views. And that normally, you know, I almost... It was beginning to feel really uncomfortable for me because I was saying, what's wrong? Where, you know, where are they?
Let me briefly translate. Also, Frau Catherine Austin Fitz ist früher in der Bush-Regierung Assistant, wie heißt das, Minister für Housing und urbane Entwicklung gewesen. Sie hat außerdem als Investmentbankerin gearbeitet, sich immer für Geld interessiert und ist dann aber irgendwann auf die Spur gekommen, dass das, was hier an Finanzwirtschaft und an Finanzpolitik existiert, und das kann ich aus meiner Tätigkeit, ich habe mal für die Deutsche Bank gearbeitet, inzwischen verklagen wir sie nach Strich und Faden, nur bestätigen, dass das kriminell ist. Wir haben es mit einer, was die Finanzindustrie angeht, mit einer riesigen kriminellen Organisation zu tun. Das sieht sie auch so. Und sie hat auf ihrem Solari Report, sucht sie und hilft sie Anlegern bei der Suche für ein Investment in Unternehmen, die nicht kriminell sind, sondern die produktiv sind, nicht notwendigerweise nur im Sinne von finanziell, sondern auch in anderer Hinsicht, weil es darum geht, den Menschen dabei zu helfen, ein freies und inspiriertes Leben zu führen. Sie sagt außerdem, dass sie einer der meist untersuchten Menschen ist im Sinne von Geheimdienstuntersuchungen. Es hat wohl Dutzende von Rechtsstreiten gegeben. Sie weist auf den Film Enemy of the State hin. Ich weiß nicht, wie der auf Deutsch heißt, aber ich glaube, vielleicht hieß er genauso. Und da sieht sie sich als die Figur des Will Smith, der damals in dem Film beobachtet wurde von allen Seiten gleichzeitig. Aber sie hat es alles überstanden und ist jetzt dabei, mit ihren Videos sozusagen die Welt zu erobern. Die werden zwar auch alle regelmäßig runtergenommen, aber eins davon, das Wichtigste von Planet Lockdown, so heißt das, von James Henry, der auch hier mal ein Interview mit mir gemacht hat, das ist erstaunlicherweise, sagt sie, so lange gelaufen, bis das mehrere Millionen Male gesehen worden ist. Ich glaube, haben wir das nicht auch bei uns?
Das hat sie über dein Video gesagt.
Das kann auch sein.
Das hat sie gerade über dein Video gesagt. Wir haben das auch, dieses Video, das haben wir auch, das ist auch, glaube ich, sehr schnell auf sehr, sehr hohen Klickzahlen gewesen. Ja. Dann ist es runtergegangen. Wir haben es jetzt, wir hatten es nochmal verlinkt dann auf 2020 News. Da ist es auch zu finden.
Okay.
Und da, jetzt müsste ich, erinnere mich gerade im Moment nicht, wie der
aber wenn man nachguckt, Beitrag findet man es. Und ich glaube auch bei mir auf dem Telegram hat das Corvin auch installiert. So we still have that video and of course all of our viewers are gonna view it again.
So did you know it's been translated into German?
I know there is a German version. I mean, it's the original version with German subtitles. I know we have it, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to mention one thing. Our Ulrich Groniger, who lives in Lake Constance, is translated the injection fraud article into German. So I posted a link in the chat. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I wanted to make sure you saw was our second quarter wrap up. After we did the state of our currency, the second quarter wrap up was the injection fraud. And it starts off with a list of heroes, and you're on the list.
Wow. I am so, really honored. Thank you.
The last thing I wanted to say, if I refer to any material, a lot of the material at the Solari Report is public, but if I refer to any material that's either the digital content on the website, or the hard copy, I'm happy to send copies. I'm happy to send complimentary subscriptions for anybody who wants to dive into the material. And I'm happy to send hard copies. I just need the contact information to either email the password or mail you the hard copies. And I'm delighted to do that.
Great. Super. We'll take you up on that.
Okay. The last thing, we're trying here to take the content on the state of our currencies and the going direct reset, which we just published, and sort of our view of what's happening to the central banking and financial system, mm-hmm. and make it accessible to any journalists in Europe who want to make that information available in their own languages. And we encourage you to just take it and run with it. So,
Yeah, we're going to make this available to our viewers as well. That's why I'm going to quickly translate this. Also, was immer die Zuschauer von ihr haben wollen an begleitenden Materialien zu dem, was sie uns gleich erzählen wird, insbesondere dazu, dass sie und ihre Mitarbeiter aufgrund der Erfahrung mit der kriminellen Finanzindustrie für eine Dezentralisierung des Geldsystems eintreten, stellt sie zur Verfügung, entweder als Ausdruck oder als oder eben per Mail digital. Aber es ist alles da. Wer also was haben möchte, der soll es einfach an uns sagen. Und we're going to give you our, is it on our website, the correct email address and stuff? I think so.
We can also put it into the Telegram channel and also, you know, in another little report. And then.
How did you get into this? Because of your experience, I mean, I have a similar background because I worked for Deutsche Bank for a while, and I quit when I realized that this is 26, 27 years ago, and I quit. I worked in Tokyo, Japan, and I quit when I realized that this is a highly criminal organization, and it hadn't even reached its peak then, but it was very obvious that this bank had two separate layers, one of them totally unregulated with people running around who were doing whatever they wanted on somebody else's, acting on somebody else's commands, but not being controlled by anyone in this bank.
Right. So I had a very successful career on Wall Street and I loved it. I was an investment banker and I was lucky. I was at a very small, prominent firm where I was free to do what I wanted. And so if you look at what I worked on, it was very positive, wealth creating, you know, I had no, and it's funny, a couple of times partners tried to order me to do things that were illegal. And I told them to go jump in a lake and there was no problem. You know, it was, you know, it's very much the Wild West, but it was for somebody who loves money. It was a very creative place. And the problem, I have an online book. Let me just put the link here that explains my transition from Wall Street to Washington. And it's the story when I left my firm, as many firms during that period. Wait a minute. See if that works. Did I do that right?
Do you need one of us to enable you to share the screen, or is that all taken care of?
So I think, yeah, I think I can share the screen.
Okay.
Let's see.
Yep.
Okay. So in 2006, when I settled the litigation, I did I wrote an online book to basically explain what happened. And what I do is I describe, being a partner at Dylan Reed and the transition to Washington. And part of the reason, and so this is at Dylan Reed and co.com, it's in English, Spanish, and French. I have not had it translated to German, although if there's interest, I can. So particularly if you have a German translator is looking for work, it would be a wonderful thing to do, because basically what it explains is the financial model that's been operating in the United States and the beginning of the financial coup. Okay, this is just a picture of the thing I sent you, the injection fraud. So let me get out of screen sharing for a second. Mm-hmm. Okay, wait a minute. There we go. Okay, so What happened to me was I was instructed when I went into the Bush administration to clean up a scandal. And that scandal was essentially what you're describing, and I describe in the Dylan Reed story, which is you had an overt economy, and then you had a hidden system of finance and covert economy. And what has been happening for the last couple decades as the financial coup has been going on is the covert has gotten bigger and bigger. And so various people working in the financial system, as the covert economy sort of interrupts and takes over, they decide for one reason or another to leave. And the challenge, of course, is that the financial system depends on the rule of law. So financial liquidity depends on the rule of law. And this is what I explained in the Dylan Reed story. And the successful countries and operations have been those who've been able to combine the financial liquidity that comes from a belief in the rule of law from the high margins from organized crime and financial fraud. So if I have a dollar of profit and I run it through a publicly traded stock that's trading at a multiple of 20, I have a capital gains of 20. And if I combine that machinery with the high profits of organized crime, I'm the guy with the lowest cost of capital. I win in the global, you know, in the global economic war, so to speak. Anyway, it's all described there. One of the reasons I did it was because I discovered the world was full of brilliant, talented, capable people who had absolutely no interest in the financial system. And so they weren't seeing what was happening politically. Because right now, for example, on the pandemic, what you see, and I'll use the United States as an example, Europe is similar, although different. The companies on Main Street are being declared non-essential. And then companies that are publicly traded and owned by the guys in New York are allowed to stay open. And all the cash flows are being consolidated into those companies, which holds up the stock market. Now, it's the capital gains on the stock market and related real estate that generate the political contributions that go back overtly and probably covertly to the politicians. And that is what finances the campaigns or helps to finance the campaigns. So you have this kickback machine that's operating. And that's part of what we're dealing with.
Ja, also ich hatte eben gesagt, dass ich ja mal für die Deutsche Bank gearbeitet habe. Ich bin nach wie vor davon überzeugt, dass es da eine Menge gute Leute gibt. Auch darauf weist auch Sie gerade hin. Da draußen laufen eine Menge geniale Leute rum, die nur eben die Augen zu haben und nicht so richtig wahrnehmen, was wirklich los ist. Ich habe bei der Deutschen Bank gesehen, das haben mir inzwischen andere bestätigt, dass es da zwei unterschiedliche Layer gibt, nämlich eins, was nach außen den Anschein erweckt, als sei das die Bank, und darunter laufen ein paar Leute rum, die vollkommen unreguliert auf ganz andere Kommandos hören und auch teilweise unlimitierte Geldausgabemöglichkeiten haben. Und genau das sagt Sie, ist Ihre Erfahrung bei der Bush-Administration gewesen. Sie sollte da einen Skandal aufklären. Und bei der Aufklärung dieses Skandals hat sie festgestellt, dass es einmal die normale Wirtschaft gibt, die Overt Economy. Und dann gibt es darunter noch die kriminelle Economy, die immer größer geworden ist über die letzten Jahre, die davon lebt, wie Organized Crime zu verhalten oder jedenfalls sehr eng damit zusammenzuarbeiten, mit Kickbacks und so weiter, und die jetzt im Moment davon leben, ihre Macht zu vergrößern, vielleicht auch, das ist jetzt aber nicht von ihr, sondern von mir, vielleicht auch, um nicht aufzufliegen, den Macht zu vergrößern. Und dazu, zu diesem Zweck, werden die kleinen und die mittelständische Wirtschaft werden zerstört. Das betrachtet man als non-essential, das ist nicht wirklich relevant, sehen wir hier in Deutschland und in ganz Europa, ganzen Welt, überall genauso. Deswegen geht die Gastronomie in die Knie, deswegen geht die Hotellerie in die Knie. Dieser ganze Bereich der kleinen und mittelständischen Unternehmer, während auf der anderen Seite die großen Konzerne, die selbsternannten Konzerneliten, die an der Wall Street gehandelt werden, immer mehr Geld kriegen und immer besser zurechtkommen. Okay.
Okay, so before we go further, can I understand who's listening to who's on the call and yeah, make sure I understand what they want to hear?
Oh, this is the people who are listening to us are people who are either. This is not an echo chamber, even though it may sound as though it is, but it isn't. There are a lot of people who are listening in and who are watching this these sessions who are, let me put it this way, either on the other side, because, and they're trying to spy on us, of course, but there are other people who are undecided and who really do think that they can learn something here, and that's why we're trying to make this as unbiased as possible. We're listening to everyone, more or less, except for the really bad characters. And we're trying to give people a complete picture of what's going on. We started this whole thing because all four of us, we're all of us are attorneys, and we're being advised by a group of scientists, including Dr. Wolfgang Wodak, who's also listening here. He's the one who more or less single-handedly stopped the last pandemic, the swine flu pandemic, because he was then in a position of power. He unmasked the guys who are now the same people who are running the show again, Drosten, Fauci, etc. He unmasked them because he was in a position of power 12 years ago. He was still a member of the German parliament, and he was also a member of the Council of Europe. So,
Wolfgang, I just have to say thank you.
He appreciates that.
Oh, I was in the middle of the swine flu fight in America, so I really appreciate that.
Okay.
And the other... Because I don't know who's sitting next to you, and I want to meet them.
This is my colleague, Dr. Justus Hoffmann. He's also an attorney. He specializes in tort law. And across from me is Antonia Fischer. She also specializes in tort law, in particular medical malpractice law, which comes in handy right now. And then we have, of course, my colleague, Viviane Fischer. She and I started this whole thing. And she's both a lawyer and an economist and a hat maker.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's why people are trying to, if same story all over the world, we were just educated a little bit on how the mainstream media, in particular Wikipedia, are trying to manipulate us. And she's been the victim, Viviane has been the victim of such a smear campaign very recently. Oh, yeah. And in the meantime, we're all used to this. And what these people don't understand, of course, they're always using the same tools by making her either a Nazi or an anti-Semitic or whatever. And by now, everybody knows the buzzwords. But what they didn't understand is this is a guy who she's known for 25 years. She kind of trusted her, the journalists who did an interview with her. And then he tried to destroy her, but he did it in such a patently and very offensive way that most people who read this article are now turning to us because they want to know more about the Corona Committee. So it was kind of counterproductive. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. We have a series. Some of our subscribers were very interested in all the tactics I dealt with during the litigation. And so they asked me to put together a series, and we did. It was called Deep State Tactics 101, and sort of all the different tactics that are used to stop you, slow you down, et cetera. And it's there if anybody wants to see it. But
absolutely, you know,
we definitely need a Wikipedia just on deep state tactics.
Yeah. For us here, the most important aspect of video with James Henry is how you detailed how the destruction of small and medium-sized businesses in the United States is actually taking place. And I think there was one part in that video in which you explained that that when you looked at the map, you realize that the worst destruction is happening in so-called opportunity zones, which were in some places somehow connected with outlets of the Federal Reserve, or did I misunderstand something there?
So what happened was, as the riots unfolded, my team and I believed that they were basically operations, mm-hmm. professionally designed, managed, and financed operations. And so the question for us was to try and understand what the goals were. Mm-hmm. And normally when you have this operations, this public and expensive, there's not one goal, they stack functions. Mm-hmm. And because I had served as Assistant Secretary of Housing, and then my company, the investment bank I started in Washington, became lead financial advisor to the Federal Housing Administration. And one of the reasons we wanted to do that assignment was we wanted to create databases that would allow us to see all money and all government money and look at it on a place-based basis. And let me back up and explain what I mean. In the United States, if you go to the White House and you download the White House budget or the financial statements, you will see everything divided by function. So how the money works in housing, how the money works in transportation, how the money works in military. You will not see the money organized around the lines by which people vote for Democratic representation. So you won't be able to get financial statements for government money in your congressional district. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's no way to align the management of the money with holding your political representatives accountable. And when relational database technology came out, one of the things I realized was a lot of political control, particularly on the secret part of the economy, the covert economy, was done by people who had that kind of intelligence. They knew how the money worked by place. The reason this is so important is if we want real solutions, we have to bring the financial system into alignment with all living beings. So we have to bring it into alignment with the environment. And living things and living intelligence, whether it is human or animal or plant or the planet, they organize around places. And so this question of how government investment and taxes works by place and how that relates to the living systems and how that relates to the voting for political representation and democracy is very important. And a lot of the dirty tricks and shenanigans in the financial system happen because people can't see what's going on. You know, they can't get a financial statement for their place, so to speak. And having dealt in the Bush administration with a lot of financial fraud, I realized the only way you can stop this financial fraud is allowing citizens to see the financial information for government money by place. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the laws related to financial management, in theory, they should be able to do that, but it's not happening. Anyway, so I got it in my head that I could get all the data out of the government, put it in big databases, and start to simulate and look at what I would call financial ecosystems continuous to living ecosystems.
Okay. Let me briefly, because Viviana just reminded me that maybe you don't even know this. This is a live stream, and we usually have sometimes we have around 100,000 viewers. Right. Later on, this can be downloaded, and we get many, many more viewers. So this reaches quite a public. And this is obviously because we have, in this case too, many, many viewers, it means that lots of people want to know what you have to tell us.
Okay.
Let me briefly translate. Also, sie hat im Rahmen ihrer Arbeit in der Bush-Administration gesehen, dass da eine Menge an finanziellen Betrügereien läuft. Sie war ja auch beauftragt, einiges davon aufzulösen. Da hat sie eben auch festgestellt, dass es diese beiden unterschiedlichen Layer an Wirtschaft gibt. Das, was ich bei der Deutschen Bank gesehen habe, das, und andere haben das auch gesehen, ich bin nicht der Einzige, das hat sie für die Wirtschaft insgesamt gesehen. Das ist da also einmal das, das ist, was man nach außen sieht, das gibt's. Und daneben gibt es diese hochkriminelle Seite, die offenbar immer mehr Überhand genommen hat. Und sie weist darauf hin, dass sie damals, als sie da anfing, nicht wusste, was sie dann gelernt hat, nämlich dass dass die Verteilung des Geldes nach Funktionen abrufbar und nachsehbar ist. Also zum Beispiel, wie viel Geld im Kongress, wie viel Geld geht in Gesundheit, wie viel Geld in Housing, wie viel geht in Transportation und so weiter rein. Aber man erkennt nicht, wie viel Geld im jeweiligen Kongressdistrikt ist. Für was? Das kann man jedenfalls nach dem derzeitigen System, vielleicht hat sich es inzwischen geändert, nicht erkennen. Bringt uns zurück, Wolfgang, zu deiner Idee, wir müssen in den Regionen unterwegs sein und da Transparenz schaffen und da politische Zusammenarbeit schaffen. Jedenfalls sagt sie, weil man das nicht erkennen kann, sind einige Leute in der Lage, die natürlich dann wissen, es gibt ja Leute, die wissen, welches Geld in welchem Kongress unterwegs ist, sind einige Leute in der Lage, das System zu manipulieren. I just explained how you found out that the difficulties that people have with understanding how money is being used in their individual congressional district opens up the gates for lots of dirty tricks and financial fraud.
So essentially in the process of mapping out, so we did very detailed mapping and simulations for all of the United States. So that's 3,100 counties in the United States. And what we discovered was, and this is the little secret, everybody always wants to know why I'm an optimist. What we discovered is that the government, that the tax and government spending and regulation was being used to centralize control of the economy, and that that centralization was phenomenally expensive. And we see the expense and the harm being done to the environment. We see the expense being done and the harm to people, you know, many different kinds of harms. But the little known secret is, in theory, if you could simply optimize the financial system in alignment with living systems, the wealth creation is mind-boggling. Now, I know doctors, scientists, and lawyers don't get as excited as wealth creation as we investment bankers. But I found it to be phenomenally exciting. And in fact, we had this wonderful PRC citizen who was working at my company, and he kept doing the simulations and coming back. And the wealth creation was so big, I kept saying, Henry, that's not possible, you know. And finally, he just said, look, you're going to have to stop and go through my numbers. And that's when I realized what was really going on. And the price, you know, I have a saying, crime that pays is crime that stays. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the price of allowing a secret economy and a class of people who operate above the law and kill with impunity, the breakdown of trust and the breakdown of liquidity and many other things in the society and the inhumanness of it, just as a financial matter, is very destructive of productivity. So we see, for example, what the pandemic is doing to productivity worldwide. The financial cost of that is enormous. And for anybody interested in sort of these questions of financial models, there is a wonderful economist from the University of Michigan, Robert Axelrod, who wrote a book called The Evolution of Cooperation about what conditions you needed to get to a peaceful economy as opposed to a war economy, which is what we have. And that's very much at the root and the heart of this. Anyway, in the process of mapping out the how the money worked in terms of central control, I was able to observe a lot of patterns related to what I call vulture capitalism or disaster capitalism in and around the real estate. And what we were watching, particularly with the development of invisible technology, whether it was the kind of technology that NSA brought to the table or electromagnetic weaponry, other kinds of weaponry, what you were seeing was more and more people use the governmental structures, government enforcement, the intelligence agencies, to make money in real estate or business within a place in a form of economic warfare. Anyway, so when the riots started, I'm a great believer that there's a major movement underfoot to accumulate a great deal of real estate in the United States. And for example, I think you saw the headline recently about Bill Gates being now the largest farm Landowner. Okay, so that's been going on ever since the financial crisis. They've been moving into bigger and bigger positions in the land. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I've been doing several Solari reports with Patrick Woods on technocracy and opportunity zones. Opportunity zone is a kind of tax pattern. When we saw the first riots happen, as I explained in Planet Lockdown, we realized that they seemed to be contiguous. There was an extraordinary number of them that were in cities that had a Fed central bank location, whether a Fed bank, there are 12 Fed banks or branches. And so I decided I would drill down and see whether there was any pattern to suggest that the riots were being used to facilitate the kind of installation of smart grids that you need in terms of building out the real estate. So if you're going to go to an all digital finance system, so central bank digital currencies, you're going to want to build out, quote unquote, the smart grid. And so the question is, how do you convert the real estate and the community infrastructure to do that? Anyway, so we have been looking at that with Patrick and some of our other allies when we realized that the riots were clearly happening in many of the Fed cities. We decided to take a look at the riots contiguous to the opportunity zones. And we started with Minneapolis. We've only done four. This is just a question of resources. We've only done four. And the first one was Minneapolis. A wonderful group in Minneapolis put up the list. There were 715, I think, buildings burned. And they put up the list of those buildings. And we mapped them and realized they were right across this major street that goes across the middle of Minneapolis, right at the base of the opportunity zone. And just being a former assistant secretary of housing, you look at that pattern and you say, oh, you know, because if I'm an investor and I'm going to try and pick up all the buildings along Lake Street in Minneapolis, and I have to pay market price, it's a very different price than if I shut them down by declaring them all non-essential, then I burn all their buildings. And then the municipality says they're going to defund the police. And oh, by the way, you've got to fix up your property. And if any of those had business interrupted insurance, which I doubt many did, you know, those guys, you know, are saying, you know, they don't cover riots or they don't cover pandemics. So basically you're putting all the business owners in a squeeze play that makes it much easier to get a hold of that real estate and to do it cheap. Now, you know, there are people who've been writing for decades about disaster capitalism, so these patterns are known. But we then proceeded to do three other cities and basically looking at the opportunity zones and the patterns of the riots, it clearly looks to me like a real estate acquisition plan. Now, to prove that in a court of law, you know, you need a lot more research, and we need a lot more information from the ground. I just want to mention one thing. One of the things that started my 11-year sojourn litigating with the Department of Justice was a software tool called Community Wizard. We were building a software tool that would allow communities to access all the federal government data that was supposed to be available as a matter of law, download it and map it out with GIS software so that they could look at the sources and uses of government money, regulations, and programs by county or within their jurisdiction. After that software tool started to really get traction, we were in the process of putting it up on the web. When the Department of Justice seized our offices, stole the software, it took me 6 years to get it out of their control. And at that point, the most valuable pieces of it had disappeared permanently. So they were stolen. And it was clear one of the things they didn't want was citizens being able to see open access of government money, because so much of it was being managed and spent outside the law.
Let me translate that because this is really important. Ich hatte Sie wegen Ihres Videos gefragt, in dem Sie im Detail berichtet hat, wie die Enteignung der kleinen und mittleren Unternehmen stattfindet und war mir nicht ganz sicher, ob ich es richtig verstanden habe. Sie hat mir jetzt aber erklärt, das habe ich wohl doch richtig verstanden, und zwar bestehen die USA nicht nur aus 50 Staaten, sondern auch aus 3.100 Counties. Ich glaube, Kalifornien alleine hat 35 Counties, das sind immer größere Gemeinden. Und Kalifornien ist ungefähr anderthalb Mal so groß wie Deutschland. Sie hat dabei festgestellt, dass die das, was sie ohnehin schon sehen konnte, dass man also nicht wirklich erkennen kann, wie das Geld, was man zwar auf der Kongressebene sehen kann, wie es für Transportation und sonst was ausgegeben wird, wie das Geld in den einzelnen Counties ausgegeben wird, hat aber gesehen, dass es offenbar sehr teuer ist, diese zentralisierte Wirtschaft aufrechtzuerhalten. Hat dann versucht zu vergleichen mit ihren Mitarbeitern, wie es anders aussehen würde, wenn das nicht zentralisiert ist, also nicht alles von oben verteilt wird, sondern wenn die Counties sich quasi selbst verwalten könnten. Und dann sagt sie, es ist unfassbar, wie hier ein Vermögenszuwachs, ein Wohlstandszuwachs erzielt werden konnte. Mindboggling, hat sie gesagt, wie wenn man diese Zentralisierung aufhebt und den Leuten vor Ort in der Region die Macht gibt, über ihre eigenen Schicksale zu entscheiden, wie sich das positiv auf die Wirtschaft auswirkt. Und sie sagt, sie hat auf einen Satz hingewiesen, in Englisch heißt der Crime that pays is crime that stays. Das ist klar, wenn sich Verbrechen lohnt, dann wird es immer schlimmer werden, wenn niemand dazwischen grätscht. Das ist vielleicht die Gelegenheit hier für uns alle, auch an dieser Stelle, an dem, was wir gerade lernen, auch für uns zu erkennen, wo unsere wirklichen Feinde sitzen. Das sind nicht die das sind nicht die Covid-Idioten oder die anderen. Jedenfalls sagt sie auch, das spiegelt sich auch in der Pandemie wieder, da kommen wir jetzt gleich auf die konkreten Hinweise, warum sich das in der Pandemie widerspiegelt, dass diese verdeckte kriminelle Economy, die also immer größer geworden ist, dass die uns sehr schädlich ist. Das können wir, glaube ich, allesamt erkennen. Da gibt es auch einen Autor, das ist Robert Axelrod, da kommen wir gleich noch drauf. Sie wird das Buch zur Verfügung stellen oder jedenfalls uns die Details dazu geben. Der hat das näher untersucht. Jedenfalls, als sie dann mit ihren Leuten ein Mapping gemacht hat, also alles kartiert hat, um festzustellen, wo ist denn nun dieser, wo wirkt sich denn am schlimmsten und wie wirkt sich am schlimmsten dieser Vulture Capitalism aus, also Aasgeier, Kappe oder wir haben das mal Heuschrecken, glaube ich, genannt, Kapitalismus aus. Da ist ihr aufgefallen, dass es diese berühmten Opportunity Zones gibt. Das sind Zonen, in die reiche, superreiche Leute ihr Geld investieren können, angeblich um den benachteiligten Regionen zu helfen. Und wenn sie da investieren, müssen sie keine Steuern zahlen. Großer, großer Vorteil. Und ihr fiel dann auf, dass die größten Zerstörungen, weil sie hat ja was mit Housing und Urban Development zu tun, also sie kennt sich aus mit Wohnungsbau. Und die größten Zerstörungen in der Nähe von den Filialen der Fed waren, und zwar in diesen Opportunity Zones. Und was da passiert ist, ist offenbar Folgendes. Die kleinen und mittleren Unternehmer, die vernünftig gewirtschaftet hatten und irgendwelche Gastronomie oder Hotels oder sonst was aufgebaut hatten oder andere Einzelhandelsgeschäfte aufgebaut hatten, die waren attraktiv. Und die waren auch deshalb attraktiv, weil da, wo der Wohlstand hochgeht, durch diese Arbeit natürlich auch der Real Estate, also die Grundstücke wertvoller werden. Da wollten die Reichen ran. Das hatte man zu Opportunity Zones vorher schon erklärt, damit die Reichen, wenn sie da rangehen, auch gleichzeitig große Steuervorteile haben. Dann kam der Lockdown. Man hat den Leuten die Möglichkeit genommen, Geld zu verdienen. Damit waren sie faktisch K.O. Diejenigen, die versucht hätten wollen zu verkaufen, also man hätte ja auch so ein Bill Gates oder so ein Jeff Bezos hätte ja sagen können, ich kaufe mir das, aber so teuer wollten sie es nicht kaufen. Die Leute, die versucht haben zu verkaufen, konnten nicht mehr verkaufen, weil die Riots da durchgegangen sind. Diese Black Lives Matter, die dann alles Mögliche zerstört haben. Sie hat das festgemacht am Beispiel Minneapolis, 715.000 Gebäude verbrannt, runtergebrannt. Und die hat natürlich auch keine, wie heißt das nochmal, diese Versicherung bei uns, diese Business Interruption
Geschäftsausfallversicherung
und selbst die eine gehabt hätten, sagt sie, genau wie bei uns, da wird er erzählen, die Versicherer, ja, dieses Risiko ist hier gerade mal nicht versichert. Also sie hat festgestellt, auch wenn das nicht gerichtsfest ist, wie sie gerade sagt, aber sie hat festgestellt, dass hier offenbar ein Muster vorliegt, wie man also den Mittelstand kaputt macht, um ihn den Superreichen und das auch noch zu steuerlich extrem vorteilhaften Konditionen zu verschaffen. Sie hat dann erzählt, sie hat ein Software-Tool entwickelt mit ihren Leuten, das nannte sich Community Wizard, und da wurde das plötzlich sichtbar, was nicht sichtbar sein sollte, nämlich wie wird das Geld jeweils in der Region am Boden sozusagen tatsächlich verwendet. Also nicht mehr nur die aus dem Kongress ersichtbare so und so viel Milliarden in Housing, so und so viel Milliarden in Transportation, sondern plötzlich sah man, was da passiert. Und dann wurden ihre Büros durchsucht, überfallen vom Department of Justice. Die haben dieses Software-Tool mitgenommen und das, als ich es dann irgendwann zurückgeklagt hatte, stellte sie fest, dass wesentliche Teile davon fehlten. Ihr Schluss daraus ist, dass offenbar jemand auf Regierungsebene, wir wissen jetzt nicht, ob da, wenn man von Regierung spricht, ob man da nur noch von Kriminellen spricht, aber jedenfalls offenbar jemand auf Regierungsebene, der das veranlasst hat, dass dieses Software-Tool Community Wizard geschlagnahmt wurde, verhindern wollte, dass die Bürger erkennen, was in ihrer jeweiligen Region finanziell los ist. Okay, I just
ja. Die Zahl der Häuser, die da runtergegangen sind, kann nicht 750.000 sein.
Nein, 715. 715 auf der einen Straße.
Okay, genau.
715 Buildings. Okay, I just explained what happened to your Community Wizard software tool. So that people, obviously someone in government, and we don't really know, is it government or is it a criminal organization that we're talking about?
I can describe that because it's multi-layered. But I just thought I would, on my screen share, I put a link so that everybody can go get these maps. But I'll do a screen share so you can see one of them. And again, this is very preliminary. We just did this was a quickie and we didn't have perfect data.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, these are all public, you can go get them. But you can see, here's the maps for Minneapolis. Yeah. And I put some other links in there too. What you can see, here's Minneapolis, and let's see where the Fed is. The Fed Bank is on here. You have a highly political Fed Bank president in Minneapolis. Oh, here's the this little green dot is the Fed right on the river. And then this is Lake Street, which is the area we look closely at.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the buildings burnt down were in a very symmetrical pattern. And it's very, you know, it's very rare that you see that kind of symmetrical pattern when you don't have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's inconceivable you have a plan, because if you look at the amount of surveillance that's happening in the United States, if this large a group of people cross state lines, which makes it a federal crime, all with smartphones, and then burn down 700 buildings in a very neat pattern, you know, and the feds do nothing, that's quite an extraordinary operation.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a great deal about the narcotics trafficking in the United States and the, you know, the multiple personality disorder we have to embrace in the United States is that we spend $1 trillion a year for the most amazing military and not a speck can cross the border without the military being free to be able to stop them. But apparently we're incapable of stopping, you know, several hundred billion dollars of cocaine and marijuana floating around in and across all the borders. It's quite a miracle. So.
Yeah.
But has there been already like acquisition of these houses? And do you know like who bought them?
So you mean in Minneapolis?
Yeah.
I can't tell you, because this is just underway now.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is most of that real estate is in the process of transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what the important thing is to put the independent producers who owned some or all of it in a position where they're forced to sell or it's attractive to sell.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're trying to do. But I have no data and haven't looked deeper. And I think one of the reasons we published this is we wanted to say to everybody in each local area, you need to drill down and look at what's really happening with the real estate.
Okay.
Because there's no way a federal or state government should allow this to happen.
Yeah.
This is completely outside the law.
So one more question, like when these houses were torn down or like attacked or like, I don't know, burnt down, was this all happening within a day, like on that riot day? Or was this, I mean, that must have been also some quite amazing amount of like people going through and doing this demolition stuff, or like how were these buildings burnt down? I mean, do you know, how can you do this like all at once? Or has this been going on over several days? Or do you have any
information? My impression is that most of these were more than one day. There were multi-day operations. But if you look at the kind of organization and personnel and labor behind it, you know, it was a pretty significant operation, is what it looked like to me. And they're trying, you know, whether the riots or the events, the rally on January 6th, they're trying to present these as sort of the people rioting. And that's clearly not what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people show up to riot and there's miraculously lots of bricks collected and dropped off for them right there.
Yeah.
So.
I have a neighbor out in California who informed me about Antifa a long time ago. I just couldn't believe it because the way that I had lived up until then, in my view, Antifa was anti-fascist young people. He explained to me, no, that's not the case. Many of them are probably uprooted people who have no family anymore, but they're there for hire. And he explained to me that they used them, not in particular, but among other groups, they used them in order to do this kind of damage. Does that sound correct?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you look at what we did, the mapping we did on the riots, we only had what information we could get on the web.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I, these patterns suggest things to me is because when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing and then when I was the Federal Housing Administration, I drilled down. We were in charge of doing due diligence and portfolio strategy for their entire $300 billion, $400 billion portfolio. And I drilled down and did a great deal of work on what the real estate acquisition patterns and disaster capitalism patterns and how the money worked. And then when I was litigating, I did a lot of research into the related financial fraud and money laundering in that portfolio. And so, you know, if you look at what was going on for the 30 years before that in the HUD real estate and foreclosure portfolios, it was very, very significant sort of private interests teamed up with the political establishment using taxpayers' money to make a fortune on real estate, including in very poor neighborhoods.
Did you see this pattern only now or back then during the financial crisis?
No, back then. And the reason I had to leave the Bush administration was because I was cleaning it. I was stopping it.
Uh-huh.
So I was putting into place the things that would stop it from happening. So I had to leave. And then I started a company and said, look, we can't trust government. What we need to do is just give the data to the local business people and entrepreneurs, and they can stop the fraud. Mm-hmm. Because the interesting thing is, once you can see the financial fraud in your place, there is so much money that can be made by stopping it. And it's much easier to stop it when you have a broad-based group of a community dealing with, federal, state, and local representatives who are not going to say, look, I'll give you a perfect example. In most neighborhoods in American counties, you can find many examples where people are unemployed but are perfectly capable of doing a job that they would love to do for $25 per hour plus healthcare. And Washington is instead centralizing that function into a contractor who's being paid $100 an hour equivalent to do it. And a political representative can't say, oh, we'd rather pay four times as much to do that function because the contractor is publicly traded and get a big pop in the stock market and we get our campaign contributions from that. You can't say that. Now, they can play that game as long as the people in that community don't understand they're paying taxes. You know, they could be hiring four people locally instead of paying a large contractor to do that function. They don't, you know, if they can see the waste, they can start to transition the waste to something more productive. Mm-hmm. But only if you have many, many, many people looking at the cash flows and taking advantage of the opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So my theory was transparency could help us move, shift directions in a very positive way. That's why we were building Community Wizard.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let me quickly translate again. Also, Sie, Frau Austin-Fitz sagt, es ist schon komisch und auffällig, dass kriminelle Aktivitäten kaum oder nicht sichtbar, nicht spürbar verfolgt werden. Sie sagt, auf der einen Seite leisten wir uns ein Militär für, was heißt das, Billionen, das heißt dann wirklich Trillions of Dollars, das sind Billionen Dollar. Auf der anderen Seite sind wir nicht in der Lage, den Narcotics Traffic, also die, das Verschieben, den Drogenhandel zu unterbinden. Der läuft für mehrere hundert Millionen oder Milliarden Dollar ungestört. Da sind offenbar Leute unterwegs, deren Geschäfte nicht gestört werden sollen. Deswegen hat man zwar auf der einen Seite das extrem teure Militär, aber auf der anderen Seite nicht die Möglichkeit gegen Dinge, die eigentlich sichtbar sind, in jeder Stadt sichtbar sind. Die Amerikaner haben eine wirkliche Drogenkrise, gerade jetzt auch wieder, zeitweise jetzt auch verursacht durch die Pharmaindustrie, die da also Schmerzmittel verschreibt ohne Ende. Es geht jeden Tag durch die Nachrichten. Da sagt sie, als Viviane nachgefragt hat, war das denn so, dass man sehen konnte, wie viele Gebäude hier durch wen wann vernichtet wurden? Sagt sie, ja, also gerichtsfest haben wir da nichts, aber es ist doch sehr auffällig, dass diese 700 noch was Gebäude offenbar innerhalb weniger Tage vernichtet wurden und dass die, sie kann auch nichts Endgültiges sagen, weil der Prozess der Vermögensverschiebung, also der Enteignung der, des Mittelstandes in jetzt dem Beispiel Minneapolis, und Übernahme dieses Vermögens, insbesondere des Immobilienvermögens, da kommt sie ja her, durch die Superreichen jetzt gerade mitten im Gang ist. Also wir können da noch kein abschließendes Wort ziehen. Sie hat außerdem festgestellt, durch die anschließende gerichtliche Auseinandersetzung, die sie hatte, dass hier eine massive Vermischung, ungute Vermischung zwischen privaten Vermögensinteressen und der Politik im Rahmen dieser Finanzcrime-Geschichte stattfindet. Sie hat es an einem Beispiel festgemacht. Sie sagt, guck mal hier, wir haben eine Menge Gegenden in den USA, wo sehr viele Arbeitslose sind, die aber gerne arbeiten würden für, sagen wir, $25 die Stunde plus Healthcare, also Gesundheitsfürsorge. Trotzdem passiert das in vielen Fällen nicht, sondern es werden große Konzerne eingesetzt, die für viel mehr Geld, nämlich für $100 die Stunde, den gleichen Job machen, beispielsweise Häuser bauen oder so. Das sind dann aber die großen Unternehmen, die auch an der Börse gehandelt werden. Dahinter stehen also die Leute, die die Fäden ziehen. Das ist das Beispiel, was sie eben gebracht hat. Sie sagt, das ist ja der Grund dafür, dass sie versucht hat, mit diesem Community Wizard Tool Transparenz reinzubringen, damit die Menschen erkennen, was los ist. Okay, so we got to that point. I just translated your example with people who are willing to work for 25 hours, $25 an hour plus healthcare, but who are not being hired, rather large contractors who are publicly traded on Wall Street. They get the job for $100 an hour.
Yeah, the Fed von der Sie, so I was wondering this Fed, when you made this connection to that there's a Fed in this specific town or like city, does this mean like the Federal Reserve? Is this like a where, so it's like, yes, the bank, yes. It's not like a military, nee, like the, nee. Okay, nicht die Bundespolizei, sondern the Fed. So why do you think that would be? Because that's kind of kind of strange. I mean, the Fed is basically organized like it's made up by you know, a set of privately owned banks. And so this is like, do you think that that specific branch of the Fed is then maybe
involved
or like trying to, or is this like just a, I mean, do you find this is significant that especially in those cities that has taken place, this destruction, like more than in other places?
So I believe that everything that is happening right now, the reason you and I are meeting today is because we are part of something called the Going Direct Reset. Mm-hmm. And the Going Direct Reset was a plan prepared at BlackRock by a group of central bankers and was presented for voting to the G7 central bankers on August 22nd, 2019. I just put a link. We just did published a big presentation by John Titus, mm-hmm, on the Going Direct Reset. I believe, you know, people talk about Klaus Schwab and the Great Reset. That's just a distraction. Uh-huh. That has nothing to do with the real, you know, the real train tracks of what's being done. The real train tracks of the Going Direct Reset. So this is a plan by the central bankers, and that plan basically induced a takedown of the entire global economy. And it induced that takedown at the same time that massive amounts of money were printed and circulated out to a variety of players who are now free to take that money and basically buy up tremendous assets. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's all explained in the Going Direct Reset. And again, I'm happy to provide, that's subscriber-only content, but I'm happy for anybody in the committee to provide a complimentary subscription. And I would really strongly recommend you read that as well as State of Our Currencies, which is an overview of not only what the reset is, but why they need to evolve the currency systems. So I think that's what's driving the train here. Mm-hmm. Now, what we are seeing as part of that is a consolidation of...
Yeah, Wolfgang?
Oh, no, I have a question if she's finished.
No, so yeah. Let me just finish. This is part of a... So what happened was the central bankers voted on the Going Direct Reset. They went into the markets in September, and in State of Our Currencies and Going Direct, you'll see the chronologies that sort of lay the whole thing out.
What September is that? Last year or 2019?
That was September 2019.
That's what I thought, because there was a huge financial crash which was covered up, and we thought that COVID or Corona was invented as a distraction for that.
But it wasn't a crash, it was a takedown.
Aha.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have to stop using words like depression or collapse. It's not a, this is a takedown.
Okay.
It's not a downturn, it's a takedown. Mm-hmm. And if you read the Going Direct, you'll understand how that works. Now, that process is moving toward, you know, you're trying to extend the reserve currency system. So you're trying to keep the existing system going, but then you're trying to bring in a new system. And that new system is a system that is an all digital system that gives you complete control. So it's no longer a currency as we know it system. It's a financial transaction system, which is a little bit like a credit at the company store, and which I would describe as a slavery system because it gives you complete control. And there are two issues here. One is the financial transactions, but the other is the digital data, because in a digital system, the data about money is worth more than money. And so you have to look at this on two tracks, both the intelligence data track and then the money track. Now, what they're trying to do is very ambitious, and a lot of this is being prototyped, like the cryptos are being prototyped, but it all depends on an all-electrical grid. It's one of the reasons they want to get off gas and oil, because mm-hmm. the control system requires an all-electrical system. And my guess is if there is a reason why the riots are happening in the Fed cities, it's because the first logical place to build out that grid is in the Fed cities. It could also be because of a variety of those things related to this. That's where the most upside opportunity is. But My guess is it's because if you go to an all crypto system, making sure you have the smart grid in the Fed locations is very, very important.
So I think we observe now that the German finance minister, that he started in when the beginning of the crisis, he started expending lots of money to many people who were following the whole plan. So there was a lot of money for science, but only for those scientists who tried to say what the government wants to hear. And there was lots of money given to the hospitals who were emptying their beds for future COVID-19 cases. So there was a lot of money mobilized and given to the doctors who were testing. They got 15 euros for one cotton wool test. And so lots of money was suddenly spent. I had the impression that money was just printed to bribe all those people who are just saying yes to what is happening. And and so they just print the money. They don't care. They just print and they can bribe everyone. And they can, if someone is critical, just give them money.
Right.
And they will stop being critical.
Right.
I think this happens even with NGOs. This is happening with all people showing up and saying, I could be critical. If you pay me some money, if you give me some money, I will stop.
Right. So what you're doing, you have independent producers. They're I'm going to grossly oversimplify. You have people who can print money and people who can earn money. They can produce. Okay. What you're trying to do is bust these people so they're financially dependent, and then they need your printed money, and then they have to do what you say.
Yeah.
So and here's what's important to understand. If you understand the consolidation of the financial coup, you're watching the central bankers take control of the treasury departments. So they've had the sovereign governments issue more and more bonds, and the sovereign governments are now dependent on the central banks to buy the bonds. And now the central bankers are moving in and essentially putting their people in place to control the treasuries. And so you have central banks that are owned privately by private people who are invisible relatively, now taking control not just of the money creation, but of the governments that depend on the central bank to buy their bonds. Now, the big secret in all of this, and one of the reasons they're so aggressive right now, is if you understand how the system works, the reality is we don't need them.
Yeah.
We don't need them to create our money.
Yeah.
We don't need them to control our data. We don't need them to run our governments. We don't need any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has happened, and which is why it's so important, Wolfgang, what you brought up, for the last 30, 40 years, they have always been able to buy most of the dissenters or the independent efforts against them with money. In other words, they have, in the democracies, they have bought the population off again and again.
They bought even Transparency International.
Right. And the question, you know, so just if you look at my journey over the last 30 years, whenever allies show up, my question is, okay, you know, how are they going to buy that person away? What are they going to? You know, and they do. No, they buy almost everybody away. And the problem is, if you have an ally who's got three young children and is trying to, you know, manage a household, and they come and they offer them, you know, a couple $100,000 a year doing something for Harvard, you know, off they go because they have a fiduciary obligation to their family. So these guys, that's why we did the deep state tactics. They're fabulous at buying almost everybody. And it's a very rare person that they can't buy. And one of the things they've done with all the money they print is to try and buy everyone into institutions and organizations that keep them busy and away from the real power lines.
Yeah.
The beauty of what's happened now is suddenly, I had one wonderful, I was in Basel for the World Freedom Alliance, and there was one wonderful member who said, you know, friends are turning up everywhere. Because we've reached a point where I think you have a lot of intelligent thinking people who realized, wait a minute, you know, some things are not a function of price. And if you look at what the destruction of human civilization and the destruction of all that's sacred or wise, you know, what these guys are doing is, you know, what we're selling down the river here is human, the future of human civilization. And, you know, and there are too many intelligent, educated people who know that that's a liquidation. That's not a business.
Also Wolfgang hat, ja.
I think it's very encouraging when you, what you just said, that we don't need them.
We don't need them.
I think the most important thing is when I imagine, I have a dream, I may say it like this, when the people just take off the mask, when they just open their shops, when they just go on doing what they always did, those people would stand there with open mouth, wouldn't understand, they would no longer be important. We could just go on living as we did before. We have to change a lot of things.
Yes.
But we could do this in a democratic way, and if we have some time to do it, we have to change things. We have to hinder them to do such things happen again. So the decentralization of money, I think, is very important.
Yes.
The decentralization of health is very important.
Yes.
There are many things we can arrange in a regional perspective, and that. If you have it in a regional perspective, this is just important for democracy, because democracy only functions when there is
right.
transparency.
Right.
When you understand what is happening, when you can go to the one who makes a failure and say, hey, stop with this. This is my responsibility. It's our responsibility. Stop this. But this is not possible if the system is too big.
Right.
You don't understand.
So let me bring up three points, because I agree with everything you just said, and you're at the heart of the matter. The first thing is, the good news is if you look at how the planet and the economy works, their system is destroying the economy, and there's plenty for everybody if we run things in a civilized way. So there's no reason why poverty is not necessary.
No.
So there are solutions. There are many different models and systems that can work. But they can't work without the rule of law, and they can't work if you put psychopaths in charge.
Yeah.
So, you know, I never want to have a conversation about, you know, socialism versus capitalism, because if you have good leadership in a place and you have a consensus on what model you want to use, the thousands of models that'll work. So,
that's right.
But the third thing, and this is the unanswered question that I don't know, and this is our risk that we have to deal with. It is clear the people doing this are building a multiplanetary civilization. They've put fantastic amounts of money, I believe, into investing in space and an underground infrastructure to facilitate what they want to do in space. The trillions of dollars that have gone missing through the financial coup have gone somewhere. And the question is, where are they going and why are they going? Now, there are millions of theories. I have no idea what's true. But the reality is, our planet is run by physical force, and that physical force ultimately is driven by who controls in space. And so if you look at the invisible technologies that can be delivered from space, you know, the weaponry, it's very, very powerful. And so if they are few and we are many, but if we organize and defy whoever it is who controls space, we need to be able to deal with that.
You're talking about 5G being used as a means of, for example, controlling us through whatever is being vaccinated, something like that.
It's not just control, but the ability to use electromagnetic weapons to drive your car off the highway or mm-hmm. blow your car up or mm-hmm. use the rod of God to blow up your village mm-hmm. or engage in, you know, so now I get into an area of speculation, which is outside my area of expertise, but I'll give you a perfect example. And I'd like permission to tell a little bit of a long story, just because mm-hmm. I think examples help. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So in 2007, I was helping a client who wanted to buy a world bond fund, and I don't like most world bond funds. So it was a long search. And I found two world bond funds from a very good sponsor And one of them had 15% of their money in Indonesian sovereign bonds. No, it must have been earlier because it was 2004. It's somewhere in there. And you'll know soon when it was. Anyway, so we found this World Bond Fund, and he made a very large investment because he wanted to buy something and just put it away, get the yield, don't worry. Very shortly after he made the investment, the fund dropped 15% overnight for no reason that we could figure. There were no change in interest rates. There was no bad news about the sponsor, about the fund, nothing. And there was massive insider trading. And if you looked at the trading that was going on, I've never seen anything like it. I've been an investment banker for decades. I've dealt with billions and hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds. I was floored. I was getting on the phone, talking to the sponsor, trying to find out what in the world was going on. No answers, complete stonewall. A week later, the tsunami in Indonesia happens. And I realized they knew. They knew there was going to be a tsunami more than a week ahead of time. Now, you know, and I sat down and I said, how do you, and then the patterns of disaster capitalism that hit in Indonesia, you know, right after the tsunami hit were, you know, it was clearly there was either somebody was anticipating it and doing it at active war, or somebody was taking tremendous advantage of what had happened. Now, you know, that brings up the question of how many of these natural disasters are weapons versus natural disasters. And I don't know. But whoever has the power to do something like that, you know, we're up against people who use significant amounts of force, and they use invisible weaponry, and they do a lot from space. And so, you know, if you look at why a prime minister would do something that is in the interest of the central banks and against his own people, it's more often than not, I believe, because he's in a variety of different squeezes, and one of them relates to this kind of weaponry. Huh. So I would just say the good news is the wealth potential is phenomenal. The bad news is we're on a planet that is controlled by force, and we need to face, you know, my pastor used to always say, if we can face it, God can fix it. We have to understand the physical force that we're up against.
Okay, let me translate that. One question, however, what do you think about the tsunami? I mean, there's two ways of explaining this. I mean, not the tsunami, but the tsunami. Do you think it was triggered by someone, or do you think there was insider trading because somebody had the means through whatever technology is up there in space to foresee this?
It had to be one or the other. I've had people who tell me they can anticipate an earthquake. Mm-hmm. You know, they can predict an earthquake, you know, fairly far into the future. So I'm assuming it could have been either. Mm-hmm. Given the patterns I've seen that have supported and protected the dollar, I'm convinced that some of these natural disasters are being induced. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the great powers behind the dollar system.
Okay. Also, Wolfgang hatte eben nochmal gefragt, dass er das Gefühl hatte, dass über die letzten Jahre, das ist dann von Frau Austin Fitz präzisiert worden, über die letzten 30 bis 40 Jahre ist das tatsächlich so gelaufen, Kritiker des Systems, die eigentlich in der Lage wären, es zu durchschauen, weggekauft wurden. Dass man einfach nur Geld gedruckt hat, Money Printing wie verrückt, und jedem, der als Kritiker hätte gefährlich werden können, genug Geld gegeben hat, damit er die Fronten wechselt. Sie sagt aber auch, dass gerade in letzter Zeit auffällig ist, vorher war es so, dass immer wieder Allies, also Weggefährten, die Unterstützer waren, praktisch weggekauft waren. Also wenn einer drei Kinder hat und irgendwie eine gute Ausbildung hat und dann wird ihm ein Job in Harvard angeboten für viel Geld, dann wird er das machen, wenn er sich dann sicher fühlt. Sie sagt, das hat sich aber jetzt geändert, weil immer mehr ihrer Freunde gemerkt haben, dass es Dinge gibt, die man nicht kaufen kann. Und das scheint jetzt diese Situation zu sein, in der wir uns befinden, zumindest nach ihrer Einschätzung, dass immer mehr Menschen merken, dass das, worum es wirklich geht, das Menschsein ist und dass die Dinge, die hier mit viel, viel Geld gekauft werden, eben teilweise nicht das ersetzen können, was ansonsten gekauft, was man eben nicht kaufen kann. Wichtig ist, glaube ich, noch, dass sie mehrfach darauf hingewiesen hat, dass wir uns in einer Transition Period befinden zwischen dem alten System, wo man noch versucht, das alte am Laufen zu halten, damit wir uns in Sicherheit wiegen, aber das neue System, was dann nur elektronisch oder elektrisch läuft, wo man uns dann eben Geld zuteilen will, dass dieses System noch nicht installiert ist. Und in der Zwischenzeit wird nach ihrer Einschätzung läuft es so, dass mit sehr viel Geld der produktive Teil der Wirtschaft gekauft wird. Irgendwann wird dann das Gelddrucken beendet werden und dann kann man mit dem Geld, was man vorher für sein Geschäft bekommen hat, das werden viele Leute mit Erschrecken feststellen, leider gar nichts mehr anfangen. Sie hat aber außerdem einen positiven Outlook, beziehungsweise erst hat sie noch ein Beispiel dafür genannt, einen positiven Outlook. Sie sagt, das System, was wir jetzt haben, das zerstört die Wirtschaft. Das System, was wir jetzt haben, brauchen wir aber auch gar nicht. Und wenn das klar ist, dass die Leute, die Geld drucken, um andere Leute aufzukaufen, völlig irrelevant sind, sondern im Gegenteil gefährlich sind für uns und für die Wirtschaft gefährlich sind. Wenn das klar ist, dann haben wir den ersten Schritt, um aus dieser Nummer rauszukommen. Auf der anderen Seite sagt sie aber auch, muss man sich darüber im Klaren sein, dass die Gegenseite über sehr viele Möglichkeiten wegen des vielen Geldes, was hier uns letzten Endes geklaut worden ist, Trillions of Dollars sind geklaut worden, im Rahmen der Finanzkrise zum Beispiel, die sie als erstes betrachtet hat, mit diesem Geld ist irgendwas gemacht worden und sie sagt, da bestehen insbesondere Möglichkeiten über wer den Weltraum beherrscht, der kann von oben mit irgendwelchen Technologien auch Dinge bewirken, zum Beispiel Erdbeben vorhersehen oder Erdbeben sogar verursachen. Sie sagt aber auch selber mehrfach, das ist jetzt Spekulation. Das ist aber ihr Gefühl und das, was sie gesehen hat in ihrer politischen Karriere, bestätigt sie darin. Also, um es nochmal zusammenzufassen, es ist so, dass immer mehr Leute merken, dass irgendwas nicht stimmt und immer mehr Leute merken, dass die Meinung, dass man mit Geld alles bezahlen kann, falsch ist, weil man eben das, was uns jetzt gerade fehlt, nicht mit Geld bezahlen kann. Wir müssen andererseits aufpassen, dass wir uns darüber im Klaren sind, dass die Gegenseite, die zwar nicht aus sehr vielen Leuten besteht, aber die über sehr viele Möglichkeiten verfügen, dass diese Gegenseite nicht unterschätzt werden darf. Trotzdem sagt sie, wenn wir, die wir ja die Mehrheit sind, vermutlich auch die Klügeren sind, wenn wir uns verbünden und gemeinsam an dieser Sache arbeiten, dann wird es klappen. So I gave them the positive outlook that you just ended with. On the one hand, it's more and more people are beginning to realize that money can't buy everything, in particular not what people really want. And on the other hand, we have to be aware of the fact that the other side is very powerful, that they have lots of means, in particular when they control space. And right.
So let me bring up something this year. So in 2021, here's where one of the places that the rubber will meet the road, and that is taxes. Mm-hmm. Because we have private owners of the central banks taking over and running the government policies in a way that is not in our interest and is not in the interest of all living things. On the other hand, we're financing them. We're financing them with our retirement savings. We're financing, many of us where we bank are financing them, but we're definitely financing them with our taxes. Now, we cannot afford to pay taxes to finance a government that uses that money illegally and in ways that harm us. And so the place where the debate between central bankers that are very expensive and we don't need and us will occur in the tax system, because they want the taxes, even though they're spending the money outside the laws of our democracies. And so, as a legal matter, and this is really a legal matter, what are the vehicles by which citizens can organize to assert the equivalent of a citizen's arrest over the money? Because what's important for our tax money is that it is spent in accordance with the law, and it is spent in the ways that we as a democratic people have determined it should be spent. Mm-hmm. So how do we make sure that our tax dollar flows within the law and for the purposes that have been designated by us as a group of citizens under a democracy? So how do we return our tax proceeds to the rule of law? And to me, that's one of the most important legal questions that we face in 2021.
Mm-hmm. To me,
if we don't speak about, if we don't speak about legal questions, if we speak about money, why do they need taxes if they can print as much money as they want?
When they print as much money as they want, they debase the currency. And the debasement of the currency can can make it harder for them to do what they want to do. And it's it's very difficult to describe the extent of their greed. So part of this is control. And part of this is just simply control. And you're trying to get 8 billion people to organize and function in a way that gives you energy. Mm-hmm. And gets them to do what you want them to do. So, for example, when I used to operate at the top of Wall Street or Washington, the conversation was never, how do we go to Rome? It's how do we get everybody making money going to Rome? Because then they'll take us to Rome. Mm-hmm. And many of the financial incentive systems are organized. So they want to build a digital control system. And so the first step is, how do we get all the freedom fighters and software developers building our system for us? Well, we'll do this thing with Bitcoin and crypto, and we'll make it fashionable and put a lot of young guys in front, and we'll get them to build our prison system for us.
Yeah, but that again boils down to what we have to do is we need transparency. We need to educate people about what's really going on so that the really brilliant right. types will not move to the other side and in effect destroy themselves, because that's what it ends up with.
Right.
But
right.
rather,
so,
yeah.
Right. So you want people to build, you want people to create wealth by building wealth as opposed to helping anybody liquidate them. Mm-hmm. So for example, the critical issue on digital systems is, how do we create digital systems where we have enough grassroots encryption to make them work for us? So one of my favorite reforms that I ever heard, I don't know if you've had Bill Binney on yet, but Bill Binney said, what we need to do is get all the homeschoolers and all the schools we can to have curriculum on encryption. Mm-hmm. And he said, if every community is creating their own homegrown encryption systems and constantly changing them, he said, it'll drive them crazy. They won't be able to deal with that. Now, I've had other people tell me quantum computing can deal with that. But I happen to believe, you know, if there is a way to create decentralized encryption, that's part of creating decentralized money. Mm-hmm. The best decentralized currency systems are systems that can operate both digitally and in physical reality. So, for example, you know, we all have local coins. Many of us have gold and silver. Just do it. You don't need to start an organization. Just start using all your coins. Mm-hmm. And that's a system, ideally, that could operate out of, you know, in physical reality and digital reality if you did it right, particularly if you had homegrown encryption. Mm-hmm. So if our ideal systems are systems that circulate currency and equity investment, you know, with our encryption on a decentralized basis in ways which are both physical and digital.
Mm-hmm. And what's the difference now between like using cash and using the coins? Is there something specific to that, or did you mean cash?
Cash is fine. The only challenge with cash is if you look at how fast they're printing money to, you know, hand out to all the LBO guys, the currency's being debased. So mm-hmm. I would encourage you, take a look at a website called the Chapwood Index. The Chapwood Index is by an investment advisor in the United States who's trying to track the increase in cost of the most basic household goods. And what it shows is real inflation in the United States, depending on where you live, has been running at 8 to 14% over the last decade. That's debasement of the currency. So by printing the money, our savings is being debased. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're on the insider and you're just getting the money, it's no problem. You know, part of the problem is the debasement of currency. The other problem that must be addressed is the usury laws. Mm-hmm. Because right now, the New York Fed banks are borrowing at 1% or less. The average credit card in the United States charges 16 to 17%. And if you lose your job because of Corona, you know, the next thing you know, you get a letter from your bank saying you have to pay 30%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's that difference. So if I'm getting printed money, then I can deal with the debasement of the currency and explosion of the cost of goods. But if I'm not, I'm squeezed. Mm-hmm.
And the point with these, you know, the ones who are basically sucking the money out of the economy is they have no problems with the devaluation of the currency because they have all assets. They have the land, the houses, the plants and all that.
Plus they have control over the new currency that they're trying to invent, right?
Right, but they're just printing money and giving it to their friends. I'm grossly oversimplifying, but to me it's they're printing money and giving it to their friends. KKR, one of the largest private equity firms. Mm-hmm. So if you read the Dylan Reed story, you'll read a little bit about KKR. But KKR just announced they're going to issue an IPO to raise $1 billion of a blind pool. Mm-hmm. Now, that means people are going to buy the stock not knowing what's going to happen to the money and where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And that's because you're talking about one of the companies best positioned to take advantage of the disaster capitalism.
Okay. Okay. Let me translate this again. Catherine Austin Fitz sagt, in 2021 wird das größte Problem sein, zu erkennen, dass die Zentralbanken, und das gilt nicht nur für die amerikanischen, die werden von privaten, die gehört privaten Leuten, die Zentralbank, dass die uns hier aussaugen. Wir bezahlen die mit unseren Steuern. Das können wir uns nicht leisten, sagt sie. Deswegen brauchen wir die Rule of Law. Wir brauchen rechtsstaatliche Möglichkeiten, um wieder für eine saubere Wirtschaft, die nicht mehr. What do you think, by the way? How much of the economy is dominated by or of the financial industry is dominated by this criminal part? Is that 50% or less?
So. If you look at who's managing whoever is managing the central banking system mm-hmm. and the related control of the treasury functions, they're controlling both the overt and covert side of the economy. Uh-huh. Currently, the organized crime globally is said to be the equivalent of the GDP of Germany. I believe it's bigger because I believe that doesn't include a lot of the financial fraud. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, we're talking about a portion of the economy that's been growing steadily since 47 and 49. If you read the Dylan Reed story, what I try and explain is the legal structures that were put into place to build the secret part of the economy, starting with the black budget and the hidden system of finance. And that portion of the economy, because it's not subject to regulations and taxes like the overt, has grown and grown and grown and pretty much bought up control. But they control both sides.
They control both sides. And that side of the story, the criminal side of the story, is probably at least 50%, if not more, or is it less?
I would say it's less than 50%.
Okay. Good.
Only
good.
Because if you look at the most essential functions. Uh-huh. They're public, they're overt, so the food supply, agriculture, uh-huh. or health. Now, I think they're being run in criminal ways. Uh-huh. So if you look at what's going on in the food supply, I think that, you know, certainly from what I know, it's being run in very, very criminal ways. Uh-huh. The one thing I would stress is if we can manage to see how this system works, we will discover one of our greatest powers, which is we're financing it. We're supporting it. We're doing it. I mean, if you look at who's implementing all of these different systems, the corruption of agriculture, the corruption of pharmaceuticals, the corruption of you name it, you know, we're the ones who are doing it, whether we're financing it with our pension funds or our retirement savings, or we're banking at the banks that are doing this, or we're paying our taxes, or, you know, so if you go through our wallets and our financial statements and balance sheets, whether it's, you know, we're going to work and getting an income from it or we're investing in it, this is us. We're doing this and we don't have to do this. And the little secret is they're destroying so much wealth, whether it's the environment, the living wealth or the family wealth. There's plenty of ways economically to turn it around.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's also basically about like cutting the greedy middleman.
No, it's not the middleman.
No, it's not the middleman, but like in general, so that you just, we do it ourselves.
The strings which we're attached to.
Yeah.
Well, here's the question. The thing that has made this system go is secrecy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that secrecy has related to, you know, military and intelligence secrecy, the black budget, mm-hmm. and invisible technology, et cetera, et cetera. And my understanding, you know, because if you look at a lot of the people in the United States who I knew personally and worked with personally who were involved deeply in that system, these were not bad people. These were not psychopaths. These were not greedy. Now, you know, they were a different generation than the ones now. And my understanding is that on more than one occasion, they've gotten in the room and tried to figure out how could we diminish the secrecy? And they can't see a practical way to do it. One, because they're trying to protect things from, you know, the true percentage of the population, which are psychopaths. But the other is there's so many different legal liabilities built up. You know, they really believe that they're dealing with risk issues that the general population in a democracy can't deal with. Mm-hmm. Now, we may agree or disagree. And where I've always disagreed with them is if you let the people optimize the economy bottom up, you know, we're all going to, there's going to be so much more wealth in the system that we can take care of whatever you need to take care of on a secret basis. But that's where the issue comes down to, is what risks are they managing and which of those risks are legitimate and which are not legitimate?
I don't think any are. I think this is part of what a psychopath is. If you become a megalomaniac and you think you're omnipotent because you're the only one who can assess the risks, then you must be a psychopath.
Okay, so let me tell you what happened in 1995. And I'm not defending this. I'm just telling you mm-hmm. what I observed. There was a huge budget fight in the United States. And this is all described in the Dylan Reed story, so I won't go into it in detail, and I encourage you to read that. Mm-hmm. But you had a group of people who for 20 years had tried desperately to get the democratic process in the United States to come up with a financially responsible solution because they knew the boomers were going to retire in 20 and 30 years, and they had to put money inside. And if you look globally, there were very few countries that were willing to do what it took to properly fund those retirement liabilities. I'm in the Netherlands right now. The Netherlands was one of the very few who really did it. Mm-hmm. It's quite an astonishing story. Anyway, at their inability to get a budget deal caused a group of people, I believe, in the leadership of the country to decide that's it, they give up. You can't manage this system in a democratic process because the criminals will always offer more money to the people and buy them politically. And so it's impossible to achieve a financially responsible solution within a democratic process because the people will always just want more free money. And I tell this the details. Now, it was just at that moment after that happened that they started to steal all the money out of the U.S. government. So they were clearly bubbling the economy and shifting money out. They started to do the predatory lending. They started to do the student loan predatory lending. They started to do, because if you cannot achieve a financially responsible solution, then you have to lower life expectancy.
When was now, this? Was this in 60?
This was at the end of 1995, starting okay, in 1996. Okay. Now, I met with a group of the top pension fund. I had a group of pension funded leaders on one of the boards of a subsidiary. We were doing a project with the Department of Labor. And I met with them in 1997 to present the plan we'd come up with under Community Wizard to re-optimize the economy bottom up. And the president of the largest pension fund in the country looked me in the eye and he said, my God, it's not hopeless. We can save the country. He said, you've got to get to Nick Brady, who'd been the treasury of the secretary and was my boss at Dylan Reed. And he said, you don't understand. They've given up on the country, they're moving all the money out starting in the fall. And that's exactly when what is now over $20 trillion started to go missing. That was the beginning of fiscal 1998. And so there was a clear decision, I believe, and I describe it all in Dylan Reed, whereby the leadership who had tried for 20 years to create a fiscally responsible infrastructure within the U.S. government decided it was hopeless. They couldn't do it. And instead, what they did was they stripped the government of trillions of dollars by bubbling it up with debt, which, P.S., they've done, you know, in countries around the world. So you bubble the debt, you suck the money out, and then after you've gotten the assets out, you turn around and the governments are full of liabilities. And those liabilities are basically promises to pay retirement, promises to pay healthcare, but you don't have, the assets are gone because you've had a financial coup. Mm-hmm. And now the question is, how do you consolidate? Mm-hmm. And if you look at what I call the magic virus, you know, the magic virus is telling the story, oh, we don't have enough money for healthcare because of the magic virus. We don't have enough money for the retirement savings because of the magic virus. But in fact, this is nothing more. You know, now that you've taken that money, now you have to basically inform people that there's, you know, you took the money and now there's no money for nursing homes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so how are you going to deal with that politically? And what we're watching is their method of dealing with the politics that they've stolen the money. Now, the reason I'm interested in what are we going to do about our taxes, because I believe the legal mechanisms exist to get that money back. And maybe not in cash form, but maybe only in equity ownership of the assets created from it. Mm-hmm. But that's where we are, because they've basically, you know, they've stolen the assets, and now what's left in the governments are liabilities, and those governments are printing more debt as fast as they can, and that's what gives the central bankers control.
Is there concrete evidence for this? I mean, for this stealing the assets because people began to realize, or they didn't realize, but they thought it's impossible to take care of the budget as far as the pension funds, et cetera, are concerned. And then they decided to bubble up the economy, student loans, for example, thereby taking the assets away, and now we're left out there standing in the rain without any assets left. Do you have concrete evidence for that?
So I would suggest, so what I've done with the Dylan Reed story, and then we've done another website called missingmoney.solari.com. I'll put mm-hmm. the link up here. Mm-hmm. So let me just do a screen share and I'll go to Missing Money. So I've been tracking since 1998 the money going missing from the federal government, and this is just U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the same thing happened all over the world.
Probably.
Oh, here, from what I know that.
Well, I know money, an extraordinary amount of money has gone missing from NATO. Mm-hmm. So I know that. Oh, wait a minute. Stop. Ah. Okay, can you see that?
It's coming up. Yeah, there it is.
Okay, so I started tracking the missing money in 1998. And then what we did, so you see all these years, mm-hmm. these are links to the documentation from two of the agencies that were missing $21 trillion as of 2015. More has been reported since, and we're in the process of doing an update. And I was doing a radio show about the $6.5 trillion that went missing in 2015. And a wonderful professor from Michigan State University heard me and thought, well, she must be wrong. And he called me. His name is Dr. Mark Skidmore. And he called me and said, oh, my God, I've checked the Department of Defense documentation, and it turns out you're right. What can I do to help? And so we agreed he and his students would do a complete survey, which is what this represents. I had it up to $12 trillion missing. He found another $9 trillion. So we have it to $21
trillion.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if you go to this website, what you'll see is lots of his documentation. I've written an article called For Institutional Investors that describe what this means, mm-hmm. Called Caveat Emptor, mm-hmm. what investors need to do due diligence on Treasury. Mm-hmm. But then what we've also done is if you go to this section on financial laws, what we've done is we've laid out all the financial management laws and monetary. If you look at all the legal structure in the United States to run both the fiscal infrastructure and the monetary infrastructure, what I had is I had two of my attorneys write out all of the different laws and infrastructure, because clearly they're operating outside the law. The big change was in October 2018. The White House and the Congress agreed bipartisan during the Kavanaugh hearings to implement something, an administrative policy called Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56, which basically says all government agencies and related entities can keep secret books and not report any of the money. And this moves it to a completely out of control system.
So can you, because that just came up again in my mind, you're saying there was no crash in September of 2019. It was a takedown. What exactly happened?
Yes. So here's, because this is complex, if you look at sort of what they did and how they did, and it's important to look at the chronologies.
Okay, give me a second. Let me first translate everything, because I think some of us are left behind, and we want no one left behind. Also, sie hat darüber berichtet, wie die Privatbanken, wie die Federal Bank, die Privaten gehört, also die Bundesbank sozusagen, die amerikanische gehört Privaten. Bei uns übrigens ist die Bankenaufsicht, die wird bezahlt von den Banken, deswegen funktioniert ja auch nichts. Sie sagt, wir werden von denen ausgesaugt, und zwar indem wir die mit unseren Steuern bezahlen, diese privaten Leute. Das Ganze ist ein rechtliches Problem. Wir müssen dafür sorgen, dass wir rechtlich die Kontrolle über unsere Steuern zurückbekommen, und dann werden wir merken, dass wir die Leute, die da oben sitzen und uns aussaugen, nicht benötigen. Das Problem ist, was sie schildert, die Leute, die uns ausplündern, sind, die sagen sich nicht, wie kommen wir nach Rom, sondern die sagen sich, wie kriegen wir die Leute dazu, dass den Weg für uns nach Rom zu pflastern, indem die schlauesten, intelligentesten Leute, die eigentlich auch was viel Besseres tun könnten, letzten Endes die Infrastruktur, die elektronische zum Beispiel, Infrastruktur für diese Leute bauen und gar nicht merken, dass sie damit ihr eigenes, in Anführungsstrichen, Todesurteil unterschreiben. Sie macht es deutlich an einem Beispiel, dieses Aussaugen, was hier im Moment läuft, an einem Beispiel, sagt, wir brauchen nicht nur die Rule of Law in general, also den Rechtsstaat im Allgemeinen, sondern wir sollten uns auch die Wucherrechte, die Wuchergesetze angucken, Usury Laws. Zum Beispiel können die privaten Banken für 1% Geld generieren oder herstellen oder zur Verfügung stellen. Die Leute, die aber mit den Kreditkarten unterwegs sind, das sind in den USA viel mehr als hier, die bezahlen auf ihre Kreditkartenschulden, wohlgemerkt 1% bezahlen die einen, und die bezahlen 16-17%. Wir haben es hier also wohl mit auf der anderen Seite wohl, weist sie nochmal drauf hin, überwiegend mit Psychopathen zu tun. Und jetzt sind wir an dem Punkt, sie hat festgestellt, dass hier Riesensummen gestohlen worden sind aus dem amerikanischen System. Und zwar hat man 95 offenbar die Entscheidung getroffen in den USA, oh mein Gott, die ganze Altersvorsorge, das kriegen wir gar nicht mehr hin, und Gesundheitsvorsorge, das schaffen wir sowieso nicht mehr. Das System ist kaputt, und hat dann Geld insgesamt, hat sie in Zusammenarbeit mit jemandem, der ihre Thesen erkannt hat, als richtig erkannt hat, rausgefunden, insgesamt 21 Billionen Dollar aus dem System geklaut. Sie sagt, das gibt es auch in anderen Gegenden, in anderen Ländern, das gibt es auch bei der NATO, ist auch sehr viel Geld verschwunden. Dieses Geld ist irgendwo geblieben, vermutlich da, wo es jetzt benutzt wird, um die Strukturen aufzubauen, die man braucht, um das System zu perfektionieren. Und dann habe ich nochmal gefragt, was ist denn nun eigentlich tatsächlich im September 2019 passiert? Sie sagt, es war kein Crash, sondern es war ein Takedown. Okay, here we are. September of 2019, what exactly happened there?
Okay, so I just realized that, wait a minute. we're going over my next appointment, so I'm going to tell them I'm late.
It's all right. I want to keep you. This is so much, and it's a horror story. But on the other hand, there is light at the end of the tunnel, I gather.
Yes, yes, yes. Of course, there's always light at the end of the
great,
tunnel.
Great, great.
Okay. Oh God, that's terribly rude. Okay. Sorry, your question again was?
What exactly happened in September of 2019? You're saying it's not a crash, it's a takedown. It's a deliberate right. takedown.
Mm-hmm. The Fed went into the repo market and started to essentially increase their balance sheet with a form of quantitative easing that put money into a variety of different hands. My guess is it, you know, essentially positioned to do what the disaster capitalists are doing. And then of course we had a big stock market crash, in the first quarter of 2020, right after an unprecedented number of sort of tech billionaires and the CEOs got their money out. And of course, when it crashes, In the equity markets, when you drop 35%, that's the line, the technical line to begin a bear market. It dropped 35% and then came back. A fantastic buying opportunity if you knew what was going on. And that is, of course, when, as the economy started to basically react to the takedown, we had the pandemic that then permitted the shutdown of Main Street. Mm-hmm. And so what you did at that point, as you're putting massive amounts of money into the big banks and institutional investors, you then shut down all of the independent producers in Main Street. So, and that gives you the ability, of course, to not only consolidate their market share into your businesses, but it gives you the ability to start picking up businesses and real estate cheap. What's very interesting is if you look at, you know, the government offered small businesses these loans to keep their payroll going. Mm-hmm. But the deal was they had to turn over a massive amount of financial data. And that financial data would have put a variety of players in position to then figure out how to engineer a shift in market share to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So like this.
Soll ich es eben übersetzen?
Okay, so I have a question, like with regards to this, you know, the takedown, as you call it, in September 2019. So because I read that there were rumors that whatever Morgan Stanley or something that they got into trouble. But do you think that's not true? It was not the question of that there would be like a lack of confidence, basically, or trust in the market, that it was an engineered thing, that's what you say, not just that one bank got, you know, that's why the repo market where people lend out money overnight, like between interbanking business.
So the highly centralized, highly leveraged financial system always has problems like that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at how the system is run, those problems, as long as the leadership coordinates well, don't ever have to turn into a problem, particularly because you can print as much as you can need. So my guess is that there was no real problem, not to say that there aren't hiccups and problems in a highly leveraged system. I think this was clearly a takedown. Uh-huh. And if you, what I would strongly recommend is that if you're interested in this aspect, that you watch the interview that I did with John Titus on the Saleri Report on the Going Direct Reset, and you read not only his write-up on the Going Direct Reset, which is on the related web presentation, but you then read State of Our Currencies, which I published in October, right before then. Mm. So if you read State of Our Currencies and the Going Direct Reset, I put the links to both of them in the chat. Mm-hmm. And they all have chronologies with it. And it's, you know, when you talk about reengineering the financial system at that point, you're talking about something that touches all the money on the planet. So in one sense, we can talk about it conceptually as to make it simple, but it's really complex. Mm-hmm. Of course. So I strongly recommend you read that. And I think what we all need is we need a way for non-financial people to be able to understand exactly what they're doing and what's happening. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get science and medicine and finance to all be able to understand what each other's saying.
And that's, you know, in that context, I also found interesting that, like, in September 19, they put, I think it was like around $170 billion into this repo market. And then during the epidemic, or like when the epidemic started, they received, so the banks in total, I think at that point received, or like in maybe it was March or so, like $2,000 billion. So basically, and at the same time, they eliminated, you know, the amount of money that the banks, or the percentage of money that banks had to deposit when they wanted to give out loans. So basically, they then sat on these like super filled, basically like treasure boxes, or what was that, Schatztruhe?
Right.
Coffers.
Well, it was very interesting because for many years, every year, all the investment advisors that I'm part of say they can't possibly keep the U.S. stock market outperforming the rest of the world for another year. They can't do that. If you look at the fundamental economic performance in Europe and in the emerging markets or in Asia, you know, the U.S. stock market can't outperform again this year. And so every year it's been another miracle that saved the American stock market. And then coming into 2020, we all said, that's it. You know, and a lot of investment advisors told me they were shifting allocations to Asia and to Europe. And then, bam, the pandemic happens. The dollar's flying, the treasury market's flying, and the U.S. stock market outperforms all the markets. It was quite, here we go again. Mm-hmm.
By very drastic measures, however.
That, you know, what I think, the people who, you know, one of the best commentators on everything that's happened for the last 2 to 4 years is C.J. Hopkins, who's in Berlin. He's right there. Do you know him?
No.
Does anybody know him?
No.
C.J. Hopkins was a very successful playwright who got so frustrated about what happened to Bernie Sanders, he started to write essays about politics. And if you look at that, our injection fraud, where you're the hero. Mm-hmm. He's also in there as one of the best sources. He wrote an article called The COVIDian Cult. Mm-hmm. And what he describes in his essays is how literally a group of people declared war on populism. So starting in 2016. And I think you've seen a group of people, certainly in the United States, the people responsible for the dollar syndicate, which is much bigger than the United States. But they started a process in 2016 to destroy the independent producer and their role financing democratic activities and expressing a democratic democratic impulse. And they think that COVID-19 has done a fabulous job of putting them back in power, and they're very pleased and happy with it. And if you look at their balance sheets, they've made a fortune. So this has been, from their point of view, politically and economically, a fantastically profitable and successful process. And they are very happy with it, and they are extremely proud of what they've done. And they're doubling down on the tactic.
Who are these people?
So, you know, my nickname for the group at the top is Mr. Global.
Yeah.
And basically the top layer is the owners of the central bank. The mystery, of course, is how does it all work? But I would say part of our problem in the United States is we have a very expensive middle management. So if you look at the people, if you take the top 100 people that you know who you would associate with running the Democratic Party in the United States, and sort of the people who support them in the House and Senate, most of which are Democrats, but there are plenty of Republicans, they are a political class. And I would say to a person, they're very pleased with what FASB 56 has done and what the, you know, sort of COVID-19 has done to consolidate their global power. There's another article I would recommend that Lee Smith just wrote called The 30 Tyrants, where he talks about how Athens used Sparta to kind of keep control by using a foreign power to attack their people. And Smith is positing the same thing with respect to China and the United States. And it's very well done and makes some very important points, because much of how America kept the false prosperity going was to sort of basically team up with China. China bought treasuries, then the treasuries went down to Walmart and bought Chinese goods, and around we go. And he's just talking about how that relates to the current election. Anyway, so you just have to understand that what we think is a very negative turn in events, to the people who are implementing this, this has been phenomenally successful. And from everything I see, they're very pleased, whether it's the central bankers or the political class that's just sort of engineered the recent elections.
Okay. Gut, also wir haben eben nochmal nachgefragt, was war denn nun tatsächlich im September 2019? Was ist ja hier bei einigen Leuten angekommen wie ein Crash? So ganz klar war es nicht. Sie sagt, nee, das war eine inszenierte Geschichte. Das war ein bewusstes Ausschalten der Geldzufuhr. Dieser Repo-Markt, das ist der Markt, in dem sich Banken gegenseitig Geld leihen. Wir haben gedacht, der ist zusammengebrochen, weil, wie du gerade gesagt hast, eine der Banken in Schwierigkeiten geraten ist. Wir haben auch gedacht, die Deutsche Bank könnte es gewesen sein, weil die ja eine Weile als gefährlichste Bank der Welt galt. Sie sagt, nee, nach ihren Ermittlungen ist das Absicht gewesen, um genau das zu inszenieren, was wir dann ein Vierteljahr oder ein halbes Jahr später gesehen haben, nämlich die Folgen dieses ausbleibenden Vertrauens innerhalb der Banken waren dann im März zu sehen, als dann tatsächlich der Lockdown inszeniert wurde, wohl als Teil dieser Strategie. Kurz vorher noch, im ersten Quartal, gab es einen Börsencrash, und zwar um 35%. Man sagt, bei 35%, da ist es immer richtig ernst. Aber kurz bevor der Crash wiederum kam, das hat sie alles analysiert, haben die Top-Leute aus den großen Konzernen Aktien verkauft, ohne Ende. Die sind also von dem Crash nicht betroffen gewesen, die haben kurz vorher verkauft. Dann kam der Crash, dann sind sie wieder eingestiegen, weil innerhalb, auf mirakulöse Art und Weise, innerhalb kürzester Zeit sind die 35% Crash wieder in die Höhe gegangen. Und nun hat sie eben erklärt, wie kann das eigentlich sein, dass der amerikanische Börsenmarkt, der völlig losgelöst ist von der Realwirtschaft, der nichts mehr mit der Realwirtschaft zu tun hat, dass er immer wieder jedes Jahr alle anderen Börsenmärkte, Deutschland, Europa weit, alle anderen Börsenmärkte outperformed hat. Alle haben gesagt, oh Scheiß, diesmal geht's aber nicht mehr gut. Es ging immer wieder gut. Und besonders im letzten Jahr ging es gut. Eine entscheidende, sie sagt, das sind die Central Banker, die Privatleute, die dahinter sind. Sie nennt diese ganze Gruppe Mr. Global. Das sind aber nicht nur die Central Banker, die Privatleute, denen die Central Banks gehören, sondern es sind eben auch die Politiker, die dabei mitspielen. Und sie sagte, eine entscheidende Entwicklung war diejenige, dass die Amerikaner mit den Chinesen zusammengearbeitet haben. Denn der scheinbare Reichtum, die scheinbar boomende Wirtschaft war erkauft. Und zwar dadurch, dass die Chinesen amerikanische Anleihen gekauft haben ohne Ende und damit natürlich auch die USA in der Hand hatten, weil die Chinesen deren Scheinwohlstand finanziert haben. Sie sagt, darin sieht man vielleicht auch eine Erklärung dafür, wie die Wahl letztes Jahr ausgegangen ist. Es ist ja dann eben nicht der Mann, der China zur Rechenschaft ziehen wollte, nämlich Trump, wieder gewählt worden, jedenfalls nach der öffentlichen Meinung nicht, sondern es ist jemand anders gewählt worden, der sehr gute chinesische Kontakte hat. That explains part of how the election went, right? The control that China has because it owns most of the debt, much of the U.S. debt, right?
No, I don't think China has significant power over the U.S.
Uh-huh.
Now, clearly, they have significant economic clout globally.
Yeah.
But I don't, China is basically a creation of the G7.
Uh-huh.
A successful China is. And so it's a much more complex story. But what you have is you have a situation where you have two groups of oligarchs scratching each other's back. So here's my suggestion. If you are interested, what I would say is the people who are interested, read State of Our Currency. I'll send you hard copies.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look at the video and the written presentation on Going Direct. Those are the best descriptions I know of what is happening in the central banking system.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do this again after you've had a chance to go through the material.
Sounds good to me.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because this is a lot of information. But
yes.
Let me just very quickly clarify, because I just made a mistake. Also sie sagt, nein, das sind nicht die Chinesen, die die ganze Macht haben, sondern es sind zwei unterschiedliche Gruppierungen von Oligarchen, die sich gegenseitig bedienen, aber die Chinesen, also die Macht in den USA haben, aber die Chinesen haben natürlich weltweit sehr viel Einfluss, sind aber die chinesische Macht, solange die funktioniert, die wirtschaftliche Macht, sind Kreationen der G7, sagt sie, also der entwickelten Länder. Es scheint sehr, 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 sehr kompliziert zu sein. Die Story insgesamt scheint mir Sinn zu machen, aber das müssen wir uns genauer angucken.
Okay, let me ask one final question. So if we follow your train of thought now, and you said that it's, they're basically like happy how it has evolved, the whole project, let's call it. Would you think that there's something that they have not taken into account? Like, for instance, I mean, you said that it's a lot about like secrecy, that it's not out there. And what we see now as like a global movement is that a lot of people are looking much more, into the details. I mean, so both on the scientific side, but also like now on this financial side. And do you think that's going to be of some sort of, so you're going to pose some sort of threat to them, to the whole scheme,
so,
let's call it?
That's an excellent question. And when in our wrap up, the injection fraud, our first section is what we call the heroes. And we put together a list of all these many doctors, scientists, attorneys, researchers, journalists who absolutely extended themselves to get to the facts of what was going on and how to protect people, whether it was protect their money or protect their health. And I hadn't realized it until I put the section together. I was blown away by what this group of people had accomplished. It was amazing. And I think these guys had no idea, especially that the medical community would share and collaborate and communicate in high speed and figure out how to protect people in the way that they did. And I think it really backed them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because the shared intelligence of this global group of these people and many more like them was so fearless, so courageous, so intelligent, because when we operate together, we're so smart. In this kind of open shared intelligence. And I think that backed on the medical side, I think this backed it up tremendously and stopped a lot of the fear from accomplishing what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they've been very frustrated. The other thing is, if you look at what they're trying to do with the injections, this is prototyping, this is experimentation, and it's very, very messy. And I think they're running into far more obstacles than they were hoping. And so That's why I think this thing of shared intelligence and what you're doing is so important, because it's like a jigsaw puzzle, both what's going on and then what we do about it. So we all have to keep putting down our pieces and trying things. Mm-hmm. And I just think we can figure it out and we can shift it in a positive direction, particularly because if you look at what they're trying to do, I think they're going to fail. It's so hard. It's so complicated. And it's so contradictory to life. And you have so many people in the leadership in that group who frankly are suffering. You know, people who win in a rigged game get stupid. Mm-hmm. And they are suffering from being in their own bell jar. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's why we have a great opportunity. And because I'm an investment banker, I just have to do this. So everybody listening, do they know how to support you? Because I think what you're doing is so great and so important.
Yeah, we're really lucky because a lot of people seem to think that we're doing something good and they are supporting us. Of course, it's important because without donations, we couldn't survive. I mean, none of us lives off of the donations. We're lawyers. But right. We need to finance some of the lawsuits for people who can't who can't pay for them. So
let me make a suggestion. We have a Take Action crowdfund. It's Larry. Mm-hmm. So could you send me the information I need to put you up on the Take Action crowdfund?
Well, that's
and
great.
Say, go support these people. And I would just say, if this has been useful for everybody listening,
it is.
How do they support you? How do they make donations?
We have a bank account and they can transfer. They're money transfers. That's what they usually do here in Europe.
I know. Do they know how to do that? Do they have a link?
Yeah, they do. There's a link. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm an investment banker. I have to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is incredible.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you. I wish I could drive. You know, it's not that far away. I wish I could drive. Are you in Berlin? Where are you?
We're in Berlin, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I wish I could drive down to Berlin and see you and see Jay Hopkins. And
we're going to have another meeting. This is so interesting, and this is so much information. We're going to have to take a closer look at some more of the details. So we'll just, if it's okay with you, we'll just try and get together again.
Let's do it.
Okay, great.
Have a great day.
Yeah,
thank you.
You too. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. So, dann können wir ein Wrap-up machen. Das hier, Wolfgang, habe ich nicht erwartet, muss ich sagen. Das war ein bisschen mehr, als ich eigentlich wissen wollte.
Ja, ich glaube, ganz entscheidend. Ich habe Sie ja gerade zum Schluss noch mal gefragt, ob Sie denn denkt, dass das... Ja, also ob das jetzt tatsächlich, weil Sie meinte ja, es geht so, also es läuft gut sozusagen, wenn man das als richtig unterstellt, wir werden das natürlich alles uns noch mal mit den ganzen Unterlagen und so weiter auseinandersetzen, was sie sagt, dass das eben eigentlich nach Plan läuft sozusagen auf der Business-Seite, was da alles jetzt so durch die gefüllten Kassen und die Möglichkeit, da möglicherweise Sachen aufzukaufen und so weiter, dass das jetzt nach ihrer Theorie sozusagen da plangerecht ist. Und dann hatte ich gefragt, ob sie denn denkt, dass da vielleicht auch durch die ganzen, weil sie auch an einem Punkt meinte, es geht halt auch viel um Geheimniskrämerei, also dass das eben, wenn das natürlich jetzt bekannt würde, was da alles so abgeht, dass das halt doch nicht nicht so gerade auf Begeisterung stoßen würde. Und da habe ich gefragt, ob sie das Gefühl hat, dass eben dadurch, dass ja jetzt weltweit, also wir sind Teil dieses Aufklärungsprozesses oder dieses investigativen Prozesses, ob da eben da vielleicht doch ein bisschen Sand ins Getriebe kommen könnte, weil eben die Leute doch einfach jetzt mehr zutage kommt, als man sich da vielleicht wünscht. Wie gesagt, jetzt die Richtigkeit ihrer Angaben unterstellt. Und da meinte sie, da sei sie ganz beeindruckt. Also wie viele Menschen, die sie auf ihrer Webseite da auch zusammengestellt hat in der Übersicht, wie viele Menschen und Gruppen da jetzt im Moment aktiv sind und wie viele auch gerade auf wissenschaftlicher und juristischer Ebene und so weiter sich ständig austauschen und dass das eben eine ganz tolle Gruppenintelligenz ist sozusagen, die da zum Tragen kommt und dass die doch eben Sand ins Getriebe zu werfen vermag. Und was sie auch zusätzlich meint, dass zum Beispiel diese Geschichte jetzt mit der Impfung, was wir auch hier mehrfach besprochen haben, dass die halt doch mehr Probleme macht, als das vielleicht jetzt so gedacht war und dadurch halt jetzt auch ein bisschen mehr, ja vielleicht will man sagen, Impfzögerlichkeit eventuell aufkommt und dadurch das Ganze eben nicht mehr so ganz nach Plan läuft.
Die schwimmen in ihrer eigenen Suppe, hat sie gesagt, und damit wird man dumm. Aber es ist tatsächlich so, dass die Leute, die hier international, so wie wir das jetzt machen, wie mit ihr gemacht haben oder mit anderen Leuten, die wir hier gehört haben, wir haben tatsächlich, so wie du sagst, Sand ins Getriebe geworfen. Deswegen haben wir die schon mal ein bisschen verlangsamt. Aber die haben sich auch selbst ein Bein gestellt mit ihren Impfungen, weil das machen viele Leute nicht mit. Wir kriegen ja ständig neue Meldungen rein von den Impfschäden. Das kann man nicht alles verheimlichen. Da kann man nicht jedes Mal erzählen, nö, das war irgendwie Altersschwäche, während vorher alles Covid war. Ne?
Das wissen die und deshalb schwenken die jetzt um auf einen anderen Impfstoff.
Ja.
Ja, ja, genau. Ja, neues Spiel, neues Glück.
Ja,
ja, genau. Die, denn, und die wollten ja auch auf einen anderen Erreger umschwenken, die sogenannten Mutanten. Das haben sie auch schon versucht, weil sie mit dem PCR-Test nicht weiterkamen, schwenken sie um auf Sequenzierung. Mhm. Also die versuchen dann, ist egal, ob was da dran ist. Die suchen irgendeine neue Story, machen eine neue Story und gewinnen damit wieder Zeit. Das ist das, was dahinter steht.
Ja. Ja.
Tja. Na gut, also ich glaube, jetzt sind wir erstmal am Ende dieser Sitzung. Das war ja wieder Wahnsinn, was wir da das irgendwie, also auf jeden Fall insbesondere auch an Nacharbeitungsaufgaben, dass wir das uns alle mal ganz genau angucken. Wir werden dazu auch dann einiges veröffentlichen, wenn sich die Dinge so tatsächlich darstellen und auch allen den Zuschauern Gelegenheit geben, eben sich selber mit den Sachen auseinanderzusetzen. Ja, also ich glaube, über Spenden hatten wir jetzt gerade schon, kann ich mir eigentlich fast sparen. Sie hatte das nochmal angesprochen, sie... genau, also
wir schicken unsere Daten auch zu ihr und dann wird sie das in den USA auch verbreiten. Wir haben das schon oft gehört, dass Amerikaner, mit denen wir gesprochen haben, gesagt haben, wie können wir euch unterstützen? Und es ist natürlich wirklich, wirklich, wirklich äußerst hilfreich, weil wir damit, die Klagen sind ja nicht billig. Wenn wir hier einen hohen Streitwert haben, dann kostet das schon ein paar Tausend pro Stück. Oder aber wenn wir jetzt, das müssen wir auch noch machen. Wir
finanzieren damit ja auch andere Sachen, zum Beispiel IT und
IT, aber jetzt auch wahrscheinlich müssen wir auch mal gucken, dass wir den armen Sören da ein bisschen aus der Falle holen. Aber das machen wir beim nächsten Mal mit dem eigenen Spendenaufruf, denke ich.
Ja, und Oval Media freut sich natürlich auch über Spenden. Die unterstützen uns ja hier mit der mit den Aufzeichnungen, mit der ganzen Kamera-Aktivitäten sozusagen, begleiten uns da. Ja, vielen Dank da auch nochmal hin. Und wir sagen dann, glaube ich, einfach Tschüss und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Ja, schönes Wochenende.
Schönes Wochenende.
Vielen Dank auch an Wolfgang Roda.
Ja, danke Wolfgang. Wir sprechen am Wochenende. Okay.
Tschüss.